Good afternoon, everyone. This is Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Meet the Professor. Today, we're going to talk about the current and future use of non-targeted therapy, specifically in metastatic non-small cell lung cancer. This is really a second or follow-up to a meeting we did during the World Lung Conference meeting on the same topic, and we decided we'd get back into it a little bit today, and we're really thrilled to have Dr. Heather Wakely as our faculty person. Heather's from the Stanford University School of Medicine and Deputy Director of the Stanford Cancer Institute. Today we're going to focus on World Conference on Lung Cancer, but also other publications and presentations outside of the targeted therapy, which again we could spend a long time on. And as is always the case in all of our meetings, we will be talking about the use of non-FDA approved agents and regimens. So check out the package insert for more specific information. As we've been doing a lot since the pandemic, in fact, I think we've presented almost 5,000 cases in various tumor types this way, or we have four general medical oncologists. I sit down with these docs, they present CLL cases, bladder cancer, breast, et cetera. And today we're gonna take a look at some of the lung cancer cases, particularly related to immunotherapy, ADCs, et cetera. We're going to kind of go back and forth between their cases, as well as some of the data from the papers that relate to the topic. Before we get into the first case, Heather, I just want to ask you, I saw a press release, I think it just came out today or yesterday, some positive data with sub-Q Pembro. We already have an approval with sub-Q atezolizumab, and I know that there's work going on with sub-Q Nivo. I'm curious, too, whether you've used sub-Q amivantamab, because that's certainly something we've heard a lot about. You know, I was mentioning in myeloma, we have the anti-CD38 antibody that went from IV, where we had gigantic problems with infusions of sub-Q, no problem. Any thoughts about sub-Q IOs and how it's going to affect clinical practice?
It's a great question. My first real experiences with sub-Q were at the amivantamab as part of clinical trial. And there, you've got this big need because the infusion reactions are such a problem with the IV formulation of that drug and essentially go away with the sub-Q. So they're a huge advantage, really looking forward to when that's approved and we don't have to go through the IV issues. I think the subcutaneous IOs, and there's always, you know, some risk of infusion reaction, but I've honestly never seen one in any of my patients. It's not something I worry about particularly. So from a toxicity standpoint, we don't have that big advantage, but there are advantages for the patient from that convenience standpoint. You know, you don't have to worry about someone's trying to find a vein, put in an IV, you just get the injection. You don't have to block off the same amount of time from your schedule. You could just sort of pop into the office and get that shot theoretically. And I think that theoretically, this could even be something the patient doesn't have to come in for, but could be brought to them potentially somewhere in the future. So as we think about how do we best deliver the right drugs to patients, this is potentially a step forward. But with everything, there are always implications in other directions too. So,
I am curious I haven't talked to too many people who have actually used sub-Q amivantamab. We're not talking about targeted therapy, but I've got to ask you because I think what I've heard is like less infusion reaction, but the other toxicities maybe not that much different. I mean, if it was just less infusion, I've heard people like really tell some stories about infusion reactions there with amivantamab, but what was your experience?
So the subcutaneous agent we've had access to as part of a clinical trial and really haven't had any infusion reactions. And we did see the randomized trial data comparing the sub-Q to the IV, which showed that the efficacy was absolutely the same, maybe even slightly better with the sub-Q. The other toxicities, as you mentioned, were about the same, but that complete reduction in the infusion reactions is huge. Very rarely do we have to call emergency responses in our infusion center, but with amivantamab, we were like, okay, who's poised with the 911, you know, in case that happens. So it's great not to have to worry about that so much in the future.
Yeah, the sooner we get that, the better. Mm-hmm. So I was about to start out with a case. You know, we have like the best chat room, so they're already I'm seeing cool stuff. Let me just throw out a quick case I saw in the chat room pop up here from Hassan. He's one of our kings of the chat room here. 44-year-old woman, adenocarcinoma stage 3A, but with a single brain met. PD-L1-10, KRAS mutated smoker. Any thoughts?
Well, I think that so I'm certainly willing to be aggressive in these oligometastatic diseases, and this is a case where we would think about going in with stereotactic radiation to that solitary brain met. And I think being more locally aggressive in the treatment, 3A can be a lot of different things, but I think thinking about a concurrent chemotherapy radiation approach with an additional durvalumab afterwards would absolutely be very reasonable. This would be a case we'd want to present in tumor board and really get everybody's input. We will sometimes start with a little bit of systemic therapy just to make sure there aren't other areas like bone mets hiding before you put the patient through an aggressive local treatment. But I still tend to be a believer in let's give the patient every potential opportunity for that long-term benefit, unless we're, again, within reason, right? You don't want to send everybody to surgery, but to weigh that additional localized therapy, such as radiation in this case, is certainly reasonable.
Has your approach to stage 3A evolved, particularly since the Pacific data came in? Are you finding more people you're sending for Pacific rather than surgery?
So that's been a bit of a back and forth. So when Pacific first came out, I'm in an academic center with 7 thoracic surgeons who are all very good. And so we didn't change too much, but I think with the Pacific, there was more of a comfort that if you go with the chemotherapy radiation approach, we've actually improved outcomes for those patients, including cure, right? Long-term survival. And so a lot more comfort in that chemo radiation strategy. I think as all of the perioperative and other studies have come out now, we've started to push the envelope of what's resectable again towards, you know, even more advanced. And this is where you need to have those tumor boards and really make sure that if you are talking about surgery, it's a surgeon who is comfortable in a patient who's had immune therapy. I hear different things from different thoracic surgeons, but there's definitely many who believe that after immune therapy, the surgical resections can be a little trickier because there could be inflammation, though sometimes easier because there's also been a higher rate of some shrinkage. So a little bit of a back and forth. But I think the key to any stage 3 is you've got to have that tumor board discussion. You've got to get the surgeons and the radoncs and the medoncs and your imaging folks and pathology in the room together or virtually together to look at the case before any treatment is started. Because once you start, you kind of alter that path. And we need to stay focused on the surgeons who do what they feel comfortable with, not what was perhaps reported at a trial with someone who's been operating for 15 years in specific just in this one disease. So
that's a great point. So let's get into some of the cases from these general oncologists. And always number one question is PD-1 negative. These are two patients. The first one has adenocarcinoma. The other one had squamous cell carcinoma, both PD-1 negative, both got chemo IO, and both are progressing. And of course, their question is the way they approach it ideal, or maybe a full-blown immunotherapy with anti-CTLA-4 therapy? Here are the cases in brief.
She had kind of standard initial treatment, carboplatin, pemetrexed, pembro, with the partial response and maintenance therapy, and then progressed 7 months later. What is the best option for these patients in the frontline setting? What if they're PD-L1 negative? Would you use a CTLA-4 inhibitor? I think many of us in the community are not as confident about using that, even though the dosing of IPI that we use in metastatic non-small cell lung cancer, it's a lot less than what you use in metastatic melanoma, but still, it's still IPI. And these patients, if anything, tend to be frailer.
We had a progression about 3 months ago. We repeated liquid biopsy again, no actionable mutation. We end up giving him a docetaxel with the ramucirumab, and he's doing well. But I think the more I want to discuss because he started having some neuropathy now. So question is, you drop the docetaxel after the 4 or 6 cycle and continue with ramucirumab as a single agent, or continue both? or since he has a disease now only a little bit in the lung and mediastinum and neck, should we add the radiation?
Any question about first-line therapy?
Now I had changed this 2024. I'm more giving ipi-nivo, people who have a PD-L1 zero. So maybe good idea to hear. And I think they have an update recently.
So, we're going to show some slides later, but I just want to kind of chat. You know, I think the last time I talked to you, I saw you kind of moving towards the combined immune therapy. So I just want to kind of get an update. Also, I mean, I heard so many problems with docetaxel remdesivir, everything from neuropathy to colitis to pleural effusions, and anything you want to weigh in terms of second line therapy. But first, your current thoughts about first line therapy in PD-1 negative patients.
So I have been swayed now that we've got data from a couple of different trials that in the patients who don't have any PD-L1 expression, that adding in that CTLA-4 probably does make a difference. And I've seen some immunological rationale behind that. And so I do think about giving, I've given CheckMate 9LA now into a couple of patients. I'm still a chemo believer, so it's a little harder to think about doing just Nevo Ipi. And I also, I'm not a big taxane user. I like the pemetrexed first line, and we don't really have as much data there. So there's still some challenges, but I do think that there is more and more compelling data that adding in the CTLA-4 with PD-L1 negative in the first line is helpful. You can never know for any patient. I also have lots of patients who got chemo and single agent checkpoint inhibitor with PD-L1 negative who's done fine. So it's not completely convincing. And I do agree with the concerns about toxicity. We do bring in higher toxicity. Anytime you bring in another immunological agent, you increase that risk of immune-related adverse events. And we've all seen cases where it's really rough. I've had a couple of patients tell me I would almost rather have the cancer still be active than deal with these side effects. So you have to be mindful, and yet it's how we move forward. It's looking at the data and trying to figure out what's the best thing for each patient. In regards to the docetaxel, I remain a weekly docetaxel user, not an every 3 weekly docetaxel user. And you got to go back way in time, but over 20 years ago, I think one of my first papers was comparing the weekly docetaxel versus the every 3 weekly regimens. I think folks who've been in practice a long time probably don't remember those weekly regimens, or haven't been in practice for a long time, maybe don't remember those, but really similar efficacy. And I find that the tolerability is just night and day. If you're given docetaxel 35 or 30 milligrams per meter squared day 1 and 8 on a 3 week regimen, you have so much better tolerability than the 75 or 60 milligrams per meter squared every 3 weeks. So I tend to use weekly. And with that, the neuropathy is often a little bit less. Tolerability is much higher. You don't have the same risks of neutropenia. So that's kind of where I tend to weigh in on that.
So actually, there's a question from the person who's about to present the next case on the video, but she's watching as well. Do you see epiphora with weekly docetaxel? Dr. Kumar, who's always on our chat room, says weekly docetaxel was inferior in prostate cancer. He also said, quote, I saw recent data showing no benefit for continuing ramucirum after stopping docetaxel. This is like a memory test to see if you can remember all these questions. And then Dilip wants to know, what about TMB and PD-L1 negative? Does that enter into your thinking? If you see a high TMB, more likely to go with double immunotherapy.
Yeah. So when we look at the toxicity differences as the first question with the weekly versus every 3 weekly, I think the major advantages are with the alopecia and with neutropenia. I think the neuropathy is a little bit less clear, and some of those other toxicities, edema, tearing, those sorts of things, probably not as much of a benefit with the weekly over the every 3 weekly for those. In regards to continuation of the anti-VEGF agent, so many questions packed into that one, going back to when we were looking at bevacizumab, right? And a lot of questions that when bevacizumab was stopped, perhaps we negated some of the benefit because you were taking away that VEGF suppression. And we saw a lot of patients with more rapid progression at that point. But there's also no data for continuation, really, of ramucirumab by itself. I don't tend to do that, but I'm also using the lower docetaxel dosing weekly. So I haven't run into that having to stop it as often. I think we don't have a definitive answer about that question. And then there was one more, Neil. I got two of them, but I can't remember the third.
Very good. You almost. Epifora.
Right.
Epifora with those. Can you prevent it and how do you manage it?
Right. So I don't have a great answer for that one. Just trying to think about the last time I saw that. You end up, even though it's like a very common thing that we talk about docetaxel with that excessive tearing, I kind of mentioned it briefly when I was going through, I haven't honestly seen it for a long time. And going back to like when I was really looking into that literature, it's still just using a lot of saline eye drops, trying to do what you can to prevent it, from that perspective. I just can't remember the data with the weekly versus the every three weekly and the challenges with that. And I have been surprised. I mean, I've started again using a lot more docetaxel recently, and just haven't really been seeing it and trying to remember the last time that I did. But it's about making sure that they're getting adequate eye drops, using those starting even before that you're giving the infusion and really continuing through at least a couple days after. I do think that the weekly, it tends to be a little bit easier because you're not getting the same peak doses. When that becomes a real challenge, I'm usually working with ophthalmologists as well. Sometimes there's a blockage that happens within the tear duct and they're able to mechanically to fix that, help with it.
Yeah, actually, Mayor in the chat room just said you send to ophthalmology and they'll often open up the lacrimal duct, like you were just saying. I have a question. You think 5 years from now we're going to go, remember when we used to use docetaxel second line, which like we never do that anymore? It's real. I thought 5 years ago we were going to be, but now by now we'd have gotten rid of it.
I think we've been asking that question for 15 years now.
15, so maybe, right?
Maybe. I think that, though I said I don't use a lot of taxanes first line, I do use a lot of taxanes second line, and it's still the docetaxel. We had some hints that maybe we were going to beat docetaxel finally, but the final results have not necessarily panned out with survival benefits. So the bar of docetaxel remains there, way up in the air. So
one of the least favorite treatments in oncology, I think. But anyhow, that we're about to see another case. This is actually from Priya, who just made that question, had that question in the chat room. Before we get into the case, this patient was actually on this ECOG trial, which I know you're a huge part of the leadership program there in the ECOG lung group. I thought it was an interesting trial. This is a patient who actually was randomized to the Pembro alone. But before we get into the case, can you just talk a little bit about the design? I know you were involved with the development of this. As far as I know, we haven't seen any data, but what the key questions were in the trial.
Right. And Haas Borghi gets a lot of credit for really being the champion of this trial. And he's now involved in the leadership for the Thoracic Committee of ECOG Akron-Rong with Julie Bramer. And really trying to answer a couple of questions here that we deal with in the real world in patients getting checkpoint inhibitors first line. One question being, in the 1 to 49% group, is single agent pembrolizumab really good choice? And that sort of arm C is bringing in that question of chemo with Pembro versus Pembro alone. This trial is for 1 to 49 or greater than 50% PD-L1 expression, no driver mutation. So asking that question, but also a probably even bigger question is that maintenance question. And so that's the arm B. So you've got arm A is Pembro alone, chemo alone, standard. That arm B is Pembro alone, and then chemo plus Pembro. Right. And that's not something we're doing standard and second line. And it's pretty tempting. And we've got some hints of data. There was the SWOG trial with Pembro ramucirumab, which looked better by continuing the Pembro. Right. And then that arm C is what I was talking about initially. It's what is the chemo adding to that Pembro alone in these groups greater than 50% and 1 to 49? So two key questions in this one trial. It was a little slow to enroll, but finally got there and waiting for results.
Just kind of curious about the high PD-1 patient outside a clinical trial nowadays. How are you deciding whether to give myo alone or not? How does age factor in? Do you ever use outside of trial single agent IO in people under 50%?
So we try to look at a lot of patient factors. I think we had one of the questions that we'd had before was about TMB. And I think of that as a couple different things. So you've got the TMB as a sort of what's sort of the number of mutations that you're dealing with, but then you've also got what's the total tumor burden in the body. And I use that total tumor burden in the body a lot to help me decide when do I want to think about adding the chemo and when do I not for patients that have high PD-L1 expression. Because I do think that with the addition of chemo, you are eradicating more of the cancer. So there are fewer cells. And then if you're getting that immune response, I mean, this is the simple way to think about it, but that's how I think about things sometimes. And so that's why I'll do that. And then you're thinking about all those other patient factors, right? So there are two sides to the question. One is, when do you think about adding the chemo and the high PD-L1? And that has to do with patients with that higher disease burden, more symptoms especially, because they need to have some reduction in their tumor burden even before they get that immune response to it. And then the other part of that question is, well, when do you de-escalate for those less than 50% and just give the PD-L1 alone? And I think that it is patients who are more frail, patients where you really don't think that they're going to tolerate chemo. And there's some other reason where you're thinking this is more likely. If someone is zero, I wouldn't do that, nor would it be indicated, right? If it's 1 or 2 or 5%, we talk about it as being pretty low likelihood. And you know, what makes them frail? Is it age? Is it comorbidities? It's all those things together that we are thinking about. But I've certainly had a couple of patients who were older have some pretty horrible immune-related adverse events. And you know, you got to always weigh what's the harm, what's that potential benefit, where are we on that scale, and what makes sense with this patient as we talk through with them.
So let's talk about this case. And I'll just say, as I've said so many times now, I appreciate so much that docs are willing to present their cases and what they do, you know, out there for anybody to take a look at. And, you know, it's really offers us a great opportunity to really get into clinical decision making. And I think this is a really good example of a challenging situation that Dr. Rudolph had to face. This 67-year-old man actually presented with a DVT, was anticoagulated, and they quickly found he had metastatic disease. Here's the case.
He got randomized to single-agent pembrolizumab, and he was on this treatment a whole year. Multiple reads by research radiologists read all his lesions to be stable disease. The lung lesion was still within the RECIST criteria of being stable. Oddly enough, despite the stability as noted on multiple images, his alkaline phosphatase right from day one up until now, a year later, has been steadily increasing and went from a baseline of 157 to now over 1100. He did not complain of any bone pain. This is a CT image of his bone lesion. So we're looking at the iliac bone lesion. As you can see, there's some sclerosis there. This was before treatment. We're looking at the PET imaging. There's active uptake in that iliac crest lesion. And when you look at his post-treatment, there's really not a whole lot of change. And if you look at the PET imaging, it looks almost identical to the pre-treatment. This is a bone scan imaging showing multiple bone lesions throughout his skeleton. And if you look at post-treatment, it is almost identical.
So that's part one. Well, part two will be was what she actually did. She also did a biopsy for what that's worth and saw active tumor growth. But, you know, plus she's on the trial. So not only is it a decision for her, but important from the trial point of view. Any thoughts about this? I mean, also, the patient had another DVT at this time when the high alk-phos. Any thoughts about continuing watching the patient, waiting to see more in terms of evolution of symptoms versus treating as relapse and, you know, having the patient go, you pointed out, second-line therapy is determined on the trial.
Mm-hmm. So very good real-world case, and I think bone metastases are one of the tricky things that we all struggle with because the imaging doesn't always give you the full story. And in this case, you know, we can look at it from the perspective of the patient might be stable. They clearly didn't have a great response, and they're on single-agent pembrolizumab. their PD-L1 level, I think it's 28%. And so this is a patient where your expectations for the single agent immune therapy maybe aren't quite as high to begin with. You're not seeing a huge response. And then you've got this ALK-FOS continuing to elevate, which could be other things, including tumor growth, could be immune reaction, could be some other source of it, right? You don't know for sure. And so it's really about discussions with the patient. Of course, the patient's on the trial, so you got to ask, you know, the people involved in the study as well to make that decision about what do we think is really best for the patient. If the patient says, I feel fine, I'm really not anxious to start the chemo, I think that's a reasonable choice. And if the other hand, you've got that new, PE, it sounds like, you've clearly not seen benefit, you're already maybe feeling a little like, oh, I kind of would have preferred they were on chemo to begin with. I think that moving forward to chemo now is also quite reasonable.
Yeah, I asked her in terms of talking. She talked to the trial people and they said, do what you think's best for the patient. Here's what happened.
Putting the two together with this rising alkaline phosphatase and now a DVT that progressed on therapeutic rivaroxaban made me really suspect that he is having progression of disease. So he is able to stay on the clinical trial. He was switched to the standard arm, which is carbapenemab and pemetrexed. He's completed 3 cycles to date. Interestingly, his alkaline phosphatase has rapidly come down from over 1,100 now to 308. And at this point, he's pending restaging scans. My question to the faculty is, his PD-L1 was 20%. We now have a new testing modality called PROFIT, non-small cell lung cancer. And I'm curious to see if Dr. Wakely has any experience with this testing. Also, do you use STK11 or KEAP1 as a marker to perhaps guide toward immunotherapy resistance? This patient did not have either of those two mutations. I also was curious, how often do you image brain in non-small cell lung patients?
So I forgot to ask you before whether you ever heard of this. I never heard of the PROFIT test. It looks like some machine learning proteomic. Mm-hmm. Have you ever heard of it? And what do you think of it? And in general, it seems like we keep looking for predictors of benefit for a long time now.
Mm-hmm. So I haven't used that one. I've heard bits about it. And certainly there are a lot of other tests trying to be developed to help us better predict when is someone going to benefit from immune therapy and when are they not. I tend to not be the first adopter of these things. So I think, and that's also part of this trial that the patients on the Insignia trial is, you know, there's also a lot of data, tissue being collected, other things being collected to then be able to try to better inform, because we will have these patients actually randomized to immune therapy alone, immune therapy plus chemo to try to help us figure out who should be which of those groups, with PD-L1 being one of those things. So I think that's one of the really important parts of this trial. But no, I haven't used the PROFIT. And then the other one is about some of these other markers. What about STK11? What about KEAP1? How does that inform you in trying to make a decision? I think my bias is already away from using single agent checkpoint inhibitors in patients at that 1 to 49% level. I just haven't been convinced that that's really the best approach for them. And so I would have already been biased towards the chemo plus IO, knowing that there are a lot of folks who do give single agent immune therapy in that patient population. I still am so happy that we got this trial enrolled and we're going to get some answers from it to be able to know what really is the best approach. I think that the data with KEAP1, STK11, some of the others is certainly interesting, but they've also all been negative prognostic factors more than really predictive to help us know what we should do. They just sort of help us know, oh, nothing's going to be that great. So that's how I'm still looking at them. But the data keeps coming. I was actually just at the LALCA meeting, so the Latin America Conference on Lung Cancer and ISLC conference, and there was some more discussions about the KEAP1 STK11, and you know, people keep looking to try to help us because we want to know who should get the checkpoint inhibitors alone, who shouldn't get them at all, who should get them with chemo, and we're still having to take a lot of different clinical factors into account, more so than the, you know, really clear science.
Yeah, that ECOG study, I think the translational data could be really interesting. What about her question about in the patient without symptoms, how often do you do brain imaging and metastatic disease? And Mayer in the chat room says, quote, getting back to Ipi-Nivo, other than PD-1 negative, what other subsets do you consider dual IO versus mono IO? He says, e.g., squamous cell keep mutated as an example. But where else are you using anti-CTLA-4? Tremelimumab, durvalumab as well as an option we'll talk about in a second.
So in regards to the brain metastases, it depends. So in patients without actionable driver mutations, oftentimes really just at the time of progression, but if it's a year, I often will look once a year. For patients with certain driver mutations like ALK, I look every 6 months. Obviously, if there's symptoms, if there's disease progression, then I'm going to bring that in otherwise. In regards to bringing in the CTLA-4, I haven't done it that often, except in patients who don't have PD-L1 expression and don't have a driver mutation. The reason being that we definitely do add toxicity, and I haven't been as convinced by the additional benefit, except in that less than one PD-L1 expression group where it was seen in a couple of different studies. I think there's probably a lot of room for different interpretations of what to do in that setting, though.
So let's take a look at some of the data that's been presented recently, and particularly at the World Lung Meeting. We saw a 5-year update of EMPOWER-1 looking at cemiplimab. Mm-hmm. Any thoughts about that? And in general, what we're seeing, particularly as we get out to the 5-year point with single agent IO, are we curing people?
I'm always so happy to see these 5-year curves, whether it's with this one or some of the other trials, just because we do have, we've got 5-year survival, right? We never thought about that 20 plus years ago when I was getting started. And we've seen pretty consistent results now across multiple trials where we're somewhere in that 20% range, 20 to 30% range of 5-year survival for these patients who presented with metastatic disease when we bring in the checkpoint inhibitors. And you can look and say, oh, but there's 15% on the chemo arm. Well, yes, but all those patients, of course, went on to get checkpoint inhibitors later on. And so it is the bringing in of the PD-1, PD-L1 checkpoint inhibitors that has lifted the curve up in these situations. And it is exciting, but it's still only 15 to 30%. And when we look at, well, how about those patients who really haven't progressed? It's lower numbers. And so we still have a lot of opportunity for improving, but at least we've made a big step forward.
And we're also, here's a survival data from Empower Lung 3 with cemiplimab. We were talking about Pembro plus chemo. We're also seeing 5-year data coming out there. We talked about CTLA-4 and chemo and IO, the CheckMate 227 study, which we've been looking at for a while now. Mm-hmm. We saw an update that was referred to by one of the docs of the CheckMate 9LA study, 5 years. Any thoughts about that?
Well, again, we're here with that 20 to 30% 5-year survival, which is really phenomenal and something we never thought about before, with even a tail on the curve with the chemo alone because of later line use of checkpoint inhibitors. I think this one is looking at with the 9LA, which of course is carboplatin paclitaxel 2 cycles with nivolumab, ipilimumab versus just chemo. And we do see that the chemo alone looks pretty similar for both of these groups. And when we look at the groups that have the nivolumab, ipilimumab added, it also doesn't look that different. And when we think about what it looks like with single agent pembrolizumab or others, the groups with less than 1%, that delta, that separation between chemo alone and chemo plus isn't usually quite as pronounced. And so I think that's where some of this enthusiasm is that for patients without PD-L1 expression, when you bring in the CTLA-4, you bring those responses kind of into that range that you would have expected with the single agent checkpoint inhibitors in patients with PD-L1 expression.
We also saw data from the Poseidon study now looking at durvalumab, tremelimumab, that's used all the time with hepatocellular cancer. Any thoughts about this, particularly when compared to the trials looking at Ipi-Nivo plus chemo?
Again, I think very similar. We have to be really careful. Every trial is going to have some differences. You can't look at this number and say, oh, that 15.7% is less than the 19.whatever%. I think they're all kind of in that same range. And I think this, And it's the fact that in this trial and others, we've got multiple studies where the PD-L1 expression doesn't seem to matter as much when you bring the CTLA-4 in as it does when you're just dealing with PD-1, PD-L1 checkpoint inhibitors alone. So that to me is really kind of the take-home message. And we do have a lot of PD-1, PD-L1 checkpoint inhibitors to choose from. We also have some CTLA-4 inhibitors to choose from. I'm not at a point where I can look at the data, and I don't think anyone is, and say, oh, this is definitely better than that one. I think we've got different trials that have had different levels of positivity, but the trends for most of them, I realize there's some outliers, but for most have been fairly similar. And so it does make it hard to pick which drugs to use because there's a lot of similarity.
So I saw a question in the chat room as soon as we started about this drug, ivosnecimib, the bispecific. It was just presented, I think, for the first time, this phase 3 trial. We've talked about this a lot. Everybody's interested in it. Everybody knows it was done in Asia. It did seem to do better than Pembro, but just kind of curious, is there going to be a phase 3 study in North America? Is there going to be an arm, three arms with another arm using just an IO plus Bev? Any thoughts about this?
So I think I was certainly in the audience when this was presented. It's great data. So I've also been a big fan of VEGF and VEGF inhibitors for a long time. A lot of trials looking there, a lot of frustration in never getting to biomarkers. And then I think as we got so excited about all the PD-1, PD-L1 checkpoint inhibitors, we kind of tended to forget about the VEGF other than docetaxel ramucirumab second line. So here we are bringing the VEGF back into first line. Is a bispecific that's bringing both of those together versus giving them separately better? There's some rationale as to why that might be true, but we haven't proven it yet. So I think we still haven't done that. I don't know that anyone ever will, to answer that question that you asked there, Neil. I think there will be further trials trying to confirm these results in a broader patient population. And it's also already, it's likely going to be approved. This is a strong phase 3 trial result. There are other bispecifics combining these and, similar sorts of ideas together, which will also be coming forward. And so it's going to be exciting times to see which of these might end up really paving the way and making that big difference. But I still think the VEGF is important, and I think that's one of the beauties of this compound, and there'll be more work to do.
So speaking of other bispecifics, any thoughts about this one, acasunlimab, which is not only being looked at alone, but also combined mm-hmm. with Pembro, so I guess hitting PD-1 at two different mm-hmm. places. Any thoughts about that? And also what kind of tolerability we might be seeing once we start mm-hmm. bringing in multiple IO or mm-hmm. immunotherapy strategies?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's definitely some encouraging signals here. I think we have to be mindful it's early. Without fail, when something is new, it's shiny and new and exciting if we're seeing any sort of signal. And it's only with more use, more patients, more time that we kind of settle out into what is this really. And so we're still kind of in the shiny new here, but it's an exciting novel approach. And I think these signals are certainly strong enough for those next phases to move forward. We also have to be mindful, and I said that earlier in this discussion, if you bring in another thing that's going to somehow alter your immune system, the probability of altering it in a way where you get an immune-related adverse event will be higher, period. That just, I think that's kind of without fail. It was interesting with the ivonescimab data. The toxicity actually was less than I think we might have expected. From the VEGF perspective, you did see some proteinuria, you did see some hypertension, but it wasn't really high levels. And it didn't really seem to alter the probability of some of the immune-related adverse events. Again, you're not bringing in another immune agent, you're bringing in a VEGF agent. So I think that, encouraging signal, more to watch. There are many, many, many other compounds with these similar ideas of what can we bring together, direct it at the same time to that same space to see if we can get a better response.
Yeah, I'm real curious to see how tarlatamab is going to play out with small cell. I guess the first CD3 bispecific mm-hmm. in a solid tumor. We talk about mm-hmm. it all the time mm-hmm. in myeloma and lymphoma. Let's drop back into a couple more cases. This one, another one from Dr. Rudolph. One of the biggest questions I hear, or most common questions I hear, is about neoadjuvant therapy, specifically chemo and IO. And I think this is a really kind of cool case that makes you think twice a little bit about it. But anyhow, here it is.
On imaging was noted to have a 6.2 centimeter right upper lobe lung mass, clinical stage 2B, T2N1, M0. Underwent a biopsy of the lung mass, which showed moderately differentiated squamous cell carcinoma. There were no actionable genomic alterations. He was PD-L1 negative. At that time, there was a recent approval of the CheckMate 816 regimen with neoadjuvant carboplatin, paclitaxel, and nivolumab. He received 3 cycles and actually developed grade 2 pneumonitis, slowly tapered his steroids over 3 weeks. His surgery did not happen for a good 2 months since completion of his last chemotherapy. Right upper lobectomy, minimal treatment effect. I'm curious to see how Dr. Wakely decides who are the best candidates for neoadjuvant chemoimmunotherapy versus going straight to surgery. Do you monitor ctDNA in this setting, and have you found it to be predictive? Understanding that we don't have data in this space, mm-hmm. Do you think it makes an impact on survival with early detection and starting treatment early based upon ctDNA? How important is it to have surgery within 4 weeks of neoadjuvant chemoimmunotherapy? I know that's how it was done on the trials. This patient had increase in size of his lung lesion. I don't know if that was because we delayed his surgery to about 2 months since his completion of initial treatment.
So, yeah, we've already had questions in the chat room. We always do about ctDNA. Any thoughts about this case and not only how you approach neoadjuvant therapy, but how you're approaching adjuvant treatment and people go right to surgery?
Mm-hmm. It's always tough, right? I think we have to acknowledge that in every neoadjuvant and all of the perioperative trials, about 20% of patients who went on those trials didn't get surgery. Now, that doesn't mean that if they hadn't gone on trial, they would have had surgery. It just means that for those on the study, that happened. And we also have to acknowledge that when we look at the adjuvant trials, the patients who were enrolled on those studies, not all of them ever got a systemic therapy at all either. And so it becomes that you've got to weigh for that patient at tumor board, what's the most important part? Because whatever you do first, the patient's likely to get, and whatever you are planning to do later may or may not happen. So this patient has a big tumor, but it's squamous with N1 disease, but not N2. And I think if the surgeon looked at that and said, this is something I could easily take out now, depending on PD-L1 expression levels, that would be one where you might argue that that patient just go to surgery first and then afterwards get that adjuvant atezolizumab if they have PD-L1 expression, or I know some folks are using the pembrolizumab in the adjuvant setting. I wouldn't do that, though, if there wasn't PD-L1 expression. I would then think about a neoadjuvant chemo and immune therapy. If you look at the data in the perioperative trials, or you got both the neoadjuvant and the adjuvant, the PD-L1 levels, patients even without, it was higher PD-L1, more benefit, but even without, there did seem to be benefit. So I kind of use that as a decision factor. The main question she was asking, though, was about ctDNA. So I'm at Stanford. I get to work with Max Dean and others who are sort of global leaders in the ctDNA space. So I'm a little biased. And we do have clinical trial right now we're doing that is ctDNA based. Patients get surgery. If they're not, they were patients who were not deemed, or I should back up, patients deemed to have needed surgery first. A lot of them are stage 1, or who refuse any systemic therapy, go on our trial with the ultra-sensitive ctDNA that, is still research based. And if we detect it, they get adjuvant treatment. And if we don't, we just watch them. So we're doing that as a trial. I think for this sort of a situation, can we use ctDNA to determine who's benefiting and who isn't early? Maybe. I don't think any of our commercial assays are sensitive enough to be comfortable that a negative is truly negative. But if you've got someone with a positive result, and then after a cycle of treatment or 2 cycles of treatment, that levels are dropping dramatically, that gives you a bit more comfort that they probably are responding. But to me, what we really need to get to is a situation where after a surgery, we can figure out who's already cured and doesn't need anymore and who isn't. And for those who aren't, if we start something, is it actually working or not, right? That's where we want to be. We're trying to get there. We're not quite there yet. As far as, is it helpful in this perioperative neoadjuvant setting to determine who's benefiting and who isn't? Maybe, but it's hard to get those tests reimbursed. And I, you know, you're going to be still using your other clinical judgment and the imaging. So I'm not sure it's that helpful yet.
Incidentally, this case was PD-1 negative, TMB of 8. So I guess if they were going to get an IO, they got it. But of course, they got the pneumonitis as well. This is a patient, a 69-year-old man who went to surgery actually for adenocarcinoma of the lung. No actional genomic alteration. You said you didn't like AGA. What do you like?
I guess there's no good. I usually say no driver mutation, but I guess no, having a three-letter NDA. Abbreviation is good. Yeah.
Okay. NDA. I think AGA is winning so far. Anyhow, PD-L1 of 5%. Here's what happened.
He underwent a right lower lobe lobectomy. And unfortunately, we did follow-up scans on him, and he was found to have a biopsy-proven recurrence in an infrahilar node. We treated him with definitive chemoradiation followed by maintenance durvalumab. Unfortunately, after the first cycle of maintenance durvalumab, he became short of breath and was diagnosed with radiation pneumonitis. So he's been on a prolonged steroid taper, and he had scans last week, and basically the hilar area is very concerning. That looks like his cancer has recurred. He has a mediastinal node. It does not look like he has distant disease. I'm curious, what second-line therapy would you think about in this gentleman?
He only had one dose of immunotherapy. Maybe that would be a possibility.
I'm just a little bit nervous, but I'm curious, do the investigators, you know, if he were to become asymptomatic, would they consider retreatment?
So any thoughts about this case and the current situation? Also looking back, the use of the Pacific strategy with recurrent disease.
So this patient's tumor is obviously a bit more aggressive, as it's now come back twice. I think, going straight in surgery, always a good approach when you've got a tumor that the surgeons think is resectable. Though I think that we're leaning, doing that neoadjuvant is also something folks think about more and more now also, but certainly reasonable. I think that when you do see a localized recurrence, like in this case, I often will also go into another locally advanced approach, chemotherapy, radiation, durvalumab. I think I would have done exactly the same as was done here. When you end up with that pneumonitis so quickly after someone's had radiation, then you're not sure, well, certainly the immune therapy added, but was it really the driving force behind it, or was that the radiation, which has now cooled down, patient's been through the steroid taper, they're doing okay, and the cancer might be back. When you see a lot of inflammation in an area where you've just done radiation, you've had an immune reaction, getting tissue can be helpful to know if it's really recurrence, but it sounds like there were some other areas also. So if you're convinced that this is recurred a second time, which it sounds like is the truth, and you're trying to think about what do you do, well, this patient did have a platinum doublet along with their radiation. It wasn't that long ago. They've had immune therapy, but just one dose. I would probably give them chemotherapy plus immune therapy, assuming that they really have cooled down from that pneumonitis that they had. I'd be watching them closely, ready to put those steroids right back on. And if it happens a second time, no more with that. But I think this patient's got a nasty tumor. It's recurred twice. I would want to give them a combined regimen at that point. So
always involve the patient in the decision, too, if they do want to be involved, because there may be multiple options, including palliative care if they really want it. Let's take a look at some more data. I think a lot of people have questions. I saw in the chat room, we always get questions about Dato-DXd. We've had such good experiences and with TDXd, obviously, not just breast cancer, but now with the pan-tumor approval. Dato has been kind of an interesting story. There we saw a difference in terms of, it looked like more benefit with non-squamous than squamous. Not much difference overall in terms of survival, but again, looking a little bit better non-squamous. Then we saw this press release. Any thoughts?
So a lot of excitement around the antibody drug conjugates, and they've certainly had approvals in other diseases, a lot of enthusiasm. As you mentioned, we've got the deruxtecan, the trastuzumab deruxtecan and targeted option for HER2 mutant lung cancer. But as far as for patients without any driving mutations, the ADC enthusiasm is sort of like, as time has gone on, it's kind of dwindled a little bit just because we haven't had anything that's really clearly been better than chemotherapy. And one of the things that's been so challenging is finding biomarkers, right? So this is a TROP2 ADC. We have sacituzumab govitecan already proved in other diseases, used a lot. So there was already awareness and excitement about this, but without a biomarker, right? You can't, TROP2 levels haven't seemed to matter. This was super exciting with datopotamab versus, this is for not this trial, but a different one. So the datopotamab deruxtecan versus docetaxel, where we saw that improvement in progression-free survival. And docetaxel, single agent, we talked about earlier, it's been so hard to beat. And we did with that trial. But then the overall survival data not really showing that clear benefit, and so less enthusiasm. One signal that has been interesting with the datopotamab deruxtecan is it works more in the adeno, didn't really seem to work in squamous compared to docetaxel. And when diving deeper into that, it was patients with driver mutations that seemed to be deriving more of the benefit. And then they had the tropion lung 05, which was just in driver mutation patients, where those with EGFR mutations seemed to really have more benefit. And so that's kind of where they're heading now, is trying to prove that. And because we've seen it now in a couple of different studies, I'm a little bit more of a believer, but the docetaxel also didn't do so well in that patient population in the comparator arm. And so I think there's still some questions, but it's reasonable to explore that. I was also really intrigued. They did do some additional work on the biomarker showing that if you could look for the TROP2 kind of in a membrane, you know, not just sort of the general levels, maybe that was more specific and helped to correlate with the response. So there's perhaps a path forward there, but it wasn't a simple biomarker to look for.
Yeah, that new biomarker looked interesting for TROP2. As you say, looking at the membrane staining, I think it was presented at the World Lung for the first time. Any thoughts about the idea of combining ADC plus IO? Of course, in bladder cancer, first-line therapy beat cisplatin-based chemotherapy and fortumab vedotin plus Pembro, now used in bladder cancer all the time. Being looked at in lung here, we have with Dato plus pembrolizumab, pretty cool-looking waterfall plot. Any thoughts again about that? I think also we've seen sacituzumab also being studied versus docetaxel. Curious about your thoughts about that. And also as well, sacituzumab, we saw last night, we were talking about breast cancer, same thing, SASI plus IO and chemo. Any thoughts about these two agents and the idea of combining with IOs?
I do think that the ADC plus IO regimens, they have shown a lot of promise, and I think it's real. I do think that bringing in that antibody, you're getting a little bit of the immune system kind of revved up, and then you bring in the checkpoint inhibitor, and so sort of a 1-2, like let's get the immune system primed, and then you got some chemo in there too. So it makes sense, and we've seen a lot of positive results. I think that the phase 2 data combining the TROP2 ADCs with immune therapy in lung cancer have been really exciting, and I'm looking forward to the phase 3 data. I do think it's likely to be positive. The sacituzumab govitecan story in lung cancer is a surprising one. I think there was a lot of enthusiasm, but unfortunately, it was a negative study. The sacituzumab versus docetaxel was actually better response, longer duration of response. The overall survival wasn't clearly different between the two. Some argued that maybe it was a little bit better with sacituzumab, but it wasn't statistically so. Maybe the docetaxel performed differently in the two trials, but it was different. It was also interesting because you didn't see that difference by histology. So with the datopotamab, it was all about the adenos. Squamous weren't benefiting. With SASI, there was no difference. And so a lot of head scratching after that result. And I think it's probably part of this change in the strategy with the datopotamab deruxtecan was based on the fact that this other TROP2 ADC wasn't really having that strong of a signal, and they neither of them were clearly showing an OS difference. So I think we're still struggling with what do we do with ADCs and lung cancer, and what do we do that's going to be better than docetaxel second line. Maybe these first line studies with the checkpoint inhibitors are going to be that path forward for them.
And also, as you said, you know, recurrent EGFR mutant disease, not only did the data look good with Dato-DXd, but also patritumab, the anti-HER3 ADC, which maybe is even going to get approved. I'll be curious. Now, we have so many options with EGFR, first line, second line. You need some kind of artificial intelligence. I have to get your thoughts on another non-targeted therapy without going into huge detail. You know, some people are what I call the skeptics. Some people a little bit more open about Tumor Treating Fields, obviously approved with GBM and mesothelioma. We saw, you know, phase three data with it was positive survival without progression-free survival. Now we're looking at it with IOs, been looking interesting in brain mets. Any thought? Doesn't seem like there's any major complications other than skin irritations in terms of toxicity. Any thoughts about its current role, if any? I mean, it is approved, or future?
I'm excited to see the ongoing study results where they're looking at this in combination with chemo and immune therapy. Remember, this was a second-line trial that was docetaxel alone or immune therapy alone, second-line. And so it was, we'd kind of moved on from those being the standard comparator arms. And it was actually interesting that it was the combination with the immune therapy that was looking much more positive than the combination with the chemotherapy. And so I'll be excited to see more there. Certainly when I hear about patients who have primary brain cancer, this is a standard approach. And I do think there is, you know, there is a reason this works, but I haven't started using it in my patients yet with lung cancer. And my meso practice is pretty small, so it just hasn't come up as much.
So I don't think we have enough time to really get into any depth about these cases. And rather, I'm just going to ask you about this case because it's super cool. Patient actually presented in 2014, got at that time ECOG 5508 looking at carboplatin bev. There was no IO there. Remember, for you new to oncology before 2015, we didn't have IOs. And this patient then had disease progression and actually got Nevo and had renal failure. And they biopsied the patient, looked like it was immune-related, didn't want to do the Nevo again. She had a isolated met in the adrenal, which she did based on a consultation, I think with Dr. Ramalingam, they decided to do SBRT, the adrenal gland. And now it's 10 years later, this lady's totally fine. It was biopsy-proven mets in the adrenal. And she's, you know, not only is it a question about treating oligomets, but also maybe she got a couple of doses of Nevo. Maybe that was enough to help out. Any thoughts about this story?
So definitely there's a correlation, and it's been shown in the literature by many. If you have an immune-related adverse event, you're more likely to have a durable response to your checkpoint inhibitor. Not that we want that to happen, but it's been seen, and I've got a couple of patients like this too, where just that one dose, horrible toxicity, but their cancer is gone, right? Is it a good trade-off? And then I do think with a single metastases, coming in with that focal radiation can be very helpful, but it's probably both of those things that led to this phenomenal outcome. It's wonderful for this patient.
Yeah, I remember when 2015, when in the first, and Nevo was the first drug that was approved, and I was like, wow, this is going to really affect the infusion centers. And now here we are 9 years later, we're talking about sub-Q. Now that's interesting as well. Heather, as always, it's been so great to work with you. I wish I could make rounds with you someday. I think everybody would love to. Audience, thank you for attending. Be safe, stay well, have a great Thanksgiving. Have a great night. Thanks so much, Heather.
Thank you.
Great to see you again. Good to see you. Take care.